Hey, everybody, and welcome back to our podcast on rights and liberties. This is Jenny, glad to be joining you again to have some fun discussions about all things rights and liberties oriented, with, of course, a focus on those that come from our Constitution, because that's really where we're tying in here. And that is the focus of today's conversation. In our first podcast, I walked through an introduction to the course and a little bit more about myself, but today's episode is really, let's get into that discussion around the Constitution and its history. I'm going to ask you at this point to navigate to Canvas and to open the Week 1 slides. If you go to the Week 1 roadmap page, these would be the Week 1 slides introduction to the course. And once you're into that space, we are ready to go. Now, given that we have already had some conversations about the class, about Canvas, and about myself, I'm going to go right down to approximately slide 10, where we are jumping into the second half of Week 1 and really focused on the Constitution and its history in terms of what is the immediate history leading to the Constitution, and what should we be thinking about as far as the context in which the framers and the founders developed their notions of rights and liberties. So on slide 10, you've got this lovely visual, this portrait of the founders and framers all sitting around, very stately and presidential looking, having signed or created this fantastic document. Some of them look like they might be talking to or whispering to one another, but nobody looks, you know, at all charged up. It's a very relaxed atmosphere. And frankly, it's completely untrue. This historical depiction is kind of a fantasy or a fiction that we like to perpetrate throughout our own history. Not because these people were necessarily good or bad people, but because we have this very sense of our founders and framers being truly principled individuals. They'd never argue, they'd never fight, they'd never roll their eyes or call each other names, which actually is exactly what they did because they were human beings. In today's conversation, I want us to talk about all of that and to challenge that story. Now, slide 11 is going to throw at you a link to the Annenberg Guide to the United States Constitution. And if you haven't yet, I'd encourage you to go read through the full text of the Constitution. It's not terribly long. Again, it's more like a how-to guide for assembling a government, at least the structures of government that they wanted. And then this Annenberg Guide supplements that by saying, okay, what does the text say? And what did they actually mean? There's sections literally called the meaning. So if you have any portions of the Constitution that you're reading through and thinking that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, check into those sections on the meaning, because they are excellent at explaining more about what was meant by the words used or even some of the intentions of the founders and the framers. Of course, I would also caution, don't take the Annenberg Guide as the total and only source on what the meaning of the Constitution is. As we will learn in this class, it is heavily debated. So we can't simply say that it means one thing or another. Now, if we were in class, we would be having a moment where I'd ask you to think about what questions you had about the Constitution, and then to discuss those with people around you, and that's slides 12 and 13 and even 14, where we bring it back to the full group and have that conversation. But I'm going to fast forward through all of that and get us into slide 15 to begin talking about the major events in the early days of the United States. And this dates back to before 1800. For those of you listening who are history buffs, I am no history major, and I'm going to really roll through the history from about 1770 to just before 1800. I'm not going to have all of the nuance and detail that you could certainly get from an American history scholar, But I will highlight some key points that maybe we would call breaking points in terms of the relationship between the colonies and the king early on. Let's say by early on, I mean a few years before we get into the Revolutionary War. And then, of course, what happens after the fact? So this timeline starts in 1770 with the Boston Massacre, an infamous massacre where you have redcoat soldiers, some of them incredibly young, we might be talking about 16, 17, 18 years old, opening fire on a crowd in Boston. Now that crowd is actively shouting at, throwing snowballs at, throwing rocks and shells at the soldiers. They are trying to instigate them. And in fact, what is claimed about the event is that someone from the crowd shouted fire to try and encourage the soldiers to open fire on the group, and they did. The officers, the commanders, contested that they ever made this kind of claim. They said they didn't tell their soldiers to open fire. And in fact, in the trial where the soldiers are put up in front of the courts in the United States, and by the way, where they are defended by John Adams, our second president, they claimed that they only opened fire because they heard it and the commander said that they never authorized them to do so. So what we end up with is a number of dead citizens in Boston after their own government, their own protection forces and the soldiers have opened fire and killed people. The Boston Massacre definitely sets a specific tone in the 1770s. And later, a few years down the road, that same hotbed of political activity, the city of Boston, hosts what's known as the Boston Tea Party. And y'all, it's not a tea party. It's a throwing of crates of tea over the side of the ships that are carrying it by the Sons of Liberty. A group that we'd probably, I mean, like, I can only say what the king would say. The king would have called them domestic terrorists at the time. And yet they were definitely colonialists who were just furious about the fact that the king is imposing these taxes on all of these goods that they use on a daily basis. I mean, we're talking about tea, we're talking about sugar, we're talking about paper. Going back to, like, the Townshend Acts, like, This is pretty old school as far as what we have for the history. But those acts date back to 1767. And essentially Parliament says, look, you guys have a lot of costs in the colonies, so we're going to tax you on glass and lead and paint and paper and tea and all of these different things you need in your day-to-day life. And that, of course, leads to the phrase, taxation without representation, because the folks in the colonies don't have a specific representative in Parliament to make their case. So this dates back to 1767. We're in 1773, and Boston ain't having it no more. So the Sons of Liberty, like I said, join the fray, engage in this activity. It's very well known. And then shortly thereafter in 1774, what we get is a sit down with a bunch of elites, land owning white individuals who, again, they don't work in like the normal day to day jobs. These are the wealthy who have the time to sit down and do these kinds of meetings and discussions. Now, it doesn't mean they aren't also working. Many of them had farms that they had to run. I mean, they're, again, not out there doing all of the backbreaking labor necessarily, although some of them certainly did. But we have this First Continental Congress, and I'm gonna put something out there that perhaps you haven't heard much about history. These folks aren't eager to overthrow the king. There's some people like Samuel Adams, who's leading the Sons of Liberty, who are definitely down for that kind of activity. But the truth is, if you think about people who are elites in one political system, they've benefited from that system. They are at the top because that system has rewarded them in some way, shape, or form. Whether we think about generational wealth or whether we think about what they have done specifically to attain, you know, the favor of the king. Now, the First Continental Congress is not something we need to spend a lot of time focusing on, but I want us to have that framework in mind when we think also about the Second Continental Congress, which happens the same month in 1775 as the battles at Lexington and Concord. The battles at Lexington and Concord are the opening of the Revolutionary War. And yet in that same month, I want to say it's April, you get the Second Continental Congress where, again, these political elites, again, these are white men who have lots of land, who have lots of wealth, who have the ability to leave their homes and sit down and have conversations like this, come together. And now we're getting a stronger push for separating from the king because we've got soldiers not only opening up on the civilians, but we have actual battles. We are pitched into a war. And are you really going to stay aligned with the people fighting you in that war? Or are you going to try and declare yourselves independent of that? Well, we don't get to that declaration until 1776. We're pretty commonly aware of that date. And I would offer the Declaration of Independence to be the greatest breakup letter of all time. That's what it is. It's a notice of separation. Hey, dude, King, we aren't down with any more of this treatment. Here's all the ways you've abused us. You've treated us poorly. So peace, we out. That's really what it says. And it starts with things like when in the course of human events it becomes necessary. But all of it boils down to a breakup note. So we're done. We're moving on with our lives. And we're going to try and form our own government. And they come up with the Articles of Confederation in 1777. Well, that is only widely known for being a failure. That's at least what I have learned in all of my classes in teaching on this topic. What we don't often know is what was actually written into the Articles of Confederation. On slide 16, you can see Articles 1, 2, and 3 of the Articles of Confederation. And, okay, they get a big win for number one. They give us the United States of America, and we definitely kept that. But Article 2 makes it clear. This is not about forming a true United States, because all of the states still retain all their power, all their freedom, all their independence. Everything that they had before, which they don't write down, now belongs to the United States, in terms of belonging to the Congress. The states did say they're going into a firm league of friendship and for their common defense, but this is really only in the context of attacks or war. And as you might imagine, once the war is going to end, this isn't going to work out so well. But we do have the articles, so we're trying to get something in place in the context of this war where we're kind of in an anarchic state. We don't have a government that we're adhering to. The states definitely do have governments that help to run things, although running things at this point in time is, again, a lot of chaos. You're in a war. We're mostly focused on sustaining our militias because we don't have a formal army at this point in time. So our fighting forces are independent from each state and built up of a lot of volunteers. I mean, we're planning to pay them, although that becomes an issue later on. Yet, we're really struggling. This isn't a time of, you know, bountiful harvest and great things. It's a struggle to get through the Revolutionary War. We don't actually adopt the Articles of Confederation until 4 years after they're drafted. And then 2 years after that, we get to the actual end of the Revolutionary War. And this is when that firm League of Friendship really breaks down. Because at the end of the war, we're struggling to put the country back together again. We have economic issues. We have problems with the farmers who were part of these militias starting to lose their land because they can't afford to pay the banks because guess what? We didn't pay our soldiers. We're struggling with that so much that it leads to events like Shays Rebellion, where Daniel Shays is leading groups who, again, are farmers that are losing their homes. And when you lose your farm and you lose your home, your family is not just homeless, you die because you don't have the kinds of structures we have in place now to offer protections. So in 1786, we get what's called the Annapolis Convention, where people come together and they're like, okay, we got to do something about this. I mean, George Washington, perhaps more than anyone else, was concerned about things like Shays Rebellion and could see that when we don't take care of the people who are parts of these militias, and by the way, have weapons, are potentially going to represent a threat to the structure and order that we've created. The Annapolis Convention in 1786 is mostly a discussion of things like trade, and we're still operating under a fairly disjointed system. We might have states with different versions of money, so good luck spending your money in Maine if you're coming from Georgia. But we're seeing this as a bigger issue with all of the Articles of Confederation. And oh, by the way, only 5 of the states out of the 13 colonies, the 13 original colonies, even showed up to this Annapolis Convention. This is going to lead us into what we eventually know of from our history classes, the 1787 Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, where we are now sitting down to fully draft a new constitution. Just to be clear, we still didn't have all 13 states there. Rhode Island is off doing its own thing. And in fact, Rhode Island is kind of this whole separate conversation. But you have every other state there, and they eventually hammer out the Constitution. But most of what they're concerned about in the Constitution is figuring out how to divide power between the states, because the state is still our functional primary system of government. People don't identify as Americans. They identify as Massachusettsian. I'm kidding. That's actually a Bay Stater. But they're Virginians. They're not Americans. Their most prominent identity is with the states. And so the state representatives are there saying, okay, are we going to go with this Virginia plan or the New Jersey plan? The Virginia plan and New Jersey plans are pictured as a summary on slide 18. So Virginia plan, do we have 2 houses of Congress and we focus on representation based on population so the big states get more power? And then the national government has a much more powerful role where it can actually legislate for states and veto state laws. This is pretty strong in terms of presenting the federal government. The New Jersey plan comes from a totally different position where it's, hey, one body of Congress, we're going to have equal representation for the states so that the small states don't, you know, get the losing end of the deal in this negotiation. And the national government, again, has a limited defense role. What they end up coming to conclude is there's a bargain between these two models. We end up with 2 houses, one based on representation by population and one with equal representation by states. And the role of the national government is neither of them. It's somewhere in between. The larger debate is really what are known as the Federalists versus the Anti-Federalists. And the Federalists are folks who mostly come from that wealthy class. This is a lot of the people at those constitutional conventions. Probably the strongest arguments for federalism come from Alexander Hamilton, who's all in on empowering the national government. But he's also supported by George Washington and James Madison, who writes a huge portion of things in our Constitution, including the Bill of Rights. And then John Jay, who ends up serving as our first Supreme Court justice, a chief justice, that is. And on the opposite side, you have Thomas Jefferson speaking more on behalf of the states and the less empowered classes, the middle and lower class. And he's backed by Patrick Henry and George Mason. And so we have the 2 sides pitched into this battle. Now, the Federalists win for the most part. And it's because of the kinds of compelling arguments that Hamilton and others make, starting with their Federalist Papers, but it's all coming from those Constitutional Convention discussions. And of course, after we get the Constitution, it still has to be ratified by the states. So these Federalists and Anti-Federalists are continuing their debates at the state ratifying conventions. And it's with the arguments out of those individuals in papers like Federalist 84 that we start to get more of a lens on the notion of rights. So what Hamilton says in 84 is the most considerable of the remaining objections, that is from the Anti-Federalists, is that the plan of the convention contains no Bill of Rights. The constitution proposed by the convention contains, as well as the constitution of this state, the state he's in, a number of such provisions. The establishment of the writ of habeas corpus, the prohibition of ex post facto laws, and of titles of nobility to which we have no corresponding provision in our Constitution are perhaps greater securities to liberty and republicanism. Now, just a quick point of clarification. Republicanism here is more representative government. It's not Republican Party based. Hamilton goes on. I go further and affirm that bills of rights, in the sense and to the extent in which they are contended for, are not only unnecessary in the proposed Constitution, but would even be dangerous. They would contain various exceptions to powers not granted, and on this very account would afford a colorable pretext to claim more than were granted. Hamilton's argument, and the argument of the Federalists, is if you try to put in a Bill of Rights, we're going to run into serious problems here. Number one, trying to contain all of those rights, that's not going to work. We're going to have to figure out what the exceptions are to this. What if we get to a point where we can't describe it all accurately? And these are not, you know, poor arguments. But for the Anti-Federalists, that's just not going to cut it. So we get to ratification of the Constitution after these Federalist-Anti-Federalist debates in the state ratifying conventions. And almost all of the states get it ratified before we have our first president. Again, minus Rhode Island, who is doing their own thing. We didn't actually need all of the states, though. Only 9 out of the 13 colonies had to ratify before the Constitution could go into effect. And yet, we have to come back to this rights discussion because the Anti-Federalists are not letting it go. 2 years after we get our first president, we actually get the Bill of Rights ratified. And that Bill of Rights is drafted by James Madison. And Madison initially puts out 12 total on the Bill of Rights. We get rid of the first two. One of those two is the actual last amendment we've had from 1992. It was the 27th Amendment. But the other 10 are what constitute the Bill of Rights, which you can see from a lovely graphic in 1971 on slide 23. In this course, we will talk about all of the rights minus the third and the 10th. We will briefly cover the third as far as your rights to not house soldiers, but that really is one we haven't had a lot of cases on, so there's not too much to share as far as our understanding of where the Supreme Court lies on that question. And we're also not going to talk about the 10th Amendment, which mostly reserves powers to the states. Now, an additional point I need to make, and something we need to emphasize, is that this is all stuff in the initial founding of the country. But there are some pretty awesome and profound arguments about how much the Civil War remade our Constitution and gave us what's known as the Second Founding. I've posted a picture here of the book by Eric Foner called The Second Founding. And again, I've heard a lot of excellent arguments about how this truly was a remaking of our Constitution because of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment is what allows us to apply the Bill of Rights, not just to Congress, but to the states. And that was the intent, to bring the states within and under those limitations. Of course, the way that the 14th Amendment was to do that was debated as well. Are we going to do this on a case-by-case basis, or the fundamental rights approach? And if we use that approach, we'd have to look at every case. We'd look at the facts of each case, how the judges feel about those facts, but not just that. We'd have to look at specific parts of each of those rights. So the First Amendment has about 5 rights built into it: speech, press, religion, assembly, petition. And we went about deciding on a case-by-case basis if speech applies to the states, if press applies to the states. We broke it down very, very small. Now, there were some individuals who argued for an approach called total incorporation. And that approach was to say, look, the whole Bill of Rights applies to the states. We don't need any case specifics. We don't need to break down the amendments into their particular pieces. We're just going to put it wholesale to the states. And frankly, this was not a realistic approach because you have a bunch of states in the South that have just been forced to reconstruct and adhere to new government rules, and you're going to have a real hard time pushing them to follow the Bill of Rights with respect to Black Americans. They're not going to do it. They're going to fight to not do it. And we're going to see cases in this class that very clearly demonstrate how much the South was unwilling to adhere to that approach. For politicians, this meant you really couldn't take that method and use it because you'd probably be looking at a second secession of the South. And even though the South was destroyed, nobody is wanting to engage in a second civil war. And a lot of people were concerned about that. I mean, we just had one. So it wasn't unrealistic to think it could happen again. What we end up with, as far as how the 14th Amendment loops in the states today, begins with the use of selective incorporation, which is the model that we've adopted after the 1960s. So once an amendment is applied using selective incorporation, we apply the whole amendment, right? So if we say the Eighth Amendment applies to the states, all parts of the Eighth Amendment apply. You can't break apart bail and fines and cruel and unusual punishment. Every part of the amendment restricts the states. Now, we haven't been great about this because for a long time we did the case-by-case thing, so we've kind of slow-rolled towards selective incorporation, but that is the model we use now. And that is what our discussions are going to be about. Our incorporation of different rights and amendments, rights through the amendments. And then we'll go beyond the Bill of Rights in this class because we're going to talk not just about the 14th Amendment, but about the amendments affecting voting. The 15th, 19th, and 26th for sure, but also I'm going to bring in the 24th just a little bit there because it relates to poll taxes, which was how the South used to prevent individuals from voting who had obtained that right under the 15th Amendment. Our last slide for this little podcast episode is the other big topic we'll cover in this course, the Supreme Court justices. We're going to get into discussion about all of them in week 3 and a little bit in week 2 because we're going to talk about our methods of interpretation. Those methods of interpretation are how we understand the justices to read and evaluate and know what the Constitution means. Kudos if you can name those individuals in that picture. Not a whole lot of Americans know the Supreme Court very well, but I would contend they are 9 of the most powerful unelected people in the United States of America. On that note, let's wrap up this episode. We're rolling in just under about 28 minutes, which is great for a first episode. I anticipate future episodes will be a fair bit longer, so feel free to break them up if you need to. And as always, let me know about any questions and concerns. You can email me at jemille@wsc.edu. I wish you all a great day/week/month, whatever you're at, and I look forward to speaking with you again soon.